When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On these gigs, you know, we're playing to between 70,000 and 100,000 people a night. So that's, you know, there's a lot of adrenaline that's coursing around. So you'll rarely just go home and go, well, I'm going to bed. Night.
Welcome back. Mark Pusey is the rock star you've definitely heard, but maybe never heard of. He's the drummer for superstars like Elton John and Ed Sheeran. But when he's not on tour and collaborating with some of the world's greatest ever artists, he's the guy pulling people out of the Thames with the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, or otherwise known as the RNLI. Before we get started in the episode, AG1 is supporting us again this week and helping me to continue to make this content. I've been taking AG1 for well over a year now because it's super convenient. AG1 replaces your multivitamin or probiotic in one simple drinkable habit. Why take a bunch of things when you can just mix one scoop of powder and water just once a day? And if you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to drinkag1.com/AndyRowe. That's drinkag1.com/AndyRowe. By doing so, you'll be supporting this podcast as well. And we had our first live show last week. Thank you so much if you managed to come along. It was a massive success. And if you want to come to next week's show, I've put the link to all the upcoming live shows in the description to this episode. Next week's at the Eagle in Ladbroke Grove in London with former Red Arrow and Top Gun pilot Dan Lowes and war hero Liz McConaughey. That's on Wednesday, the 26th of July, and we have some great stories and lots of whiskey. The following show is with rogue warrior Denny Denham and the prison governor Vanessa Frake. As I said, I'll put the link in the description to this episode, so you can just scroll down, click the link and buy your ticket. They're only 15 quid and you get a free Buffalo Trace cocktail with that and some delicious nibbles. Hope you enjoy the episode.
Mark Pusey, thanks for coming on the show, mate.
You're very, very welcome.
Where are you at the moment?
I am in Pittsburgh. Sorry, we just travelled. We've had a bit of a travel day. We're now in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania, in the United States.
Does it get like that where you're on a tour bus, or what happens? You just wake up and you're like, well, where am I? And someone asks you and you're like, oh, actually, good question.
Yeah. So I've been in order to break the tour up a little bit, because we're out here with Ed for 5 months, I've booked, like, my family are coming out and girlfriend's coming out and all that sort of stuff. And when my family are coming out, we've booked a little trip to, that's room service.
I'm all right, thank you.
Sorry. Yeah, so we're out here for about 5 months, and the plan is I've got my girlfriend's coming out a couple of times, and my folks are coming out, and they're going on a bit of a road trip, and they're going to swing by some of the dates, and I'm going to join the road trip for a few days, and just go and do some exploring and stuff. And we've been booking Airbnbs for places in Detroit. And so when people have been asking me, I've been like, oh, we're in Detroit. No, hang on a minute. I'm thinking about Detroit, but we're actually in Boston or Pennsylvania or wherever else we are. And you know what, with the travel and all the rest of it, occasionally it's the inside of one hotel room sometimes looks like the inside of another. So, you know, unless you're looking out and it's, oh, look out the window, there's a CN Tower. Okay, we must be in Toronto or whatever, you know. some of it tends to blend.
Just for someone listening to this that might not have picked up, you're on tour with Ed Sheeran at the moment.
Yeah, playing drums for his mathematics tour. Yeah, it's a long old tour that in promotion of his last album, or the most recent album, Subtract, and it's sort of the greatest hits of all the other albums in the mathematics series. So plus, divide, multiply, equals, and now lately subtract.
Is he as good as a lad? As good as a human as people make out? Like, is he as good at egg as we all think he is?
He is probably better. Like, I'm not just saying this because he employs me and he's he's a friend. But seriously, I mean, I'd deftly avoid the question if he wasn't. But he really is such a great guy. Like, on days off, he'll go into schools and give them a bunch of guitars and play for the kids, you know, and the kids will have a school band and he'll just show up unannounced and be like, oh, you know, I hear you play this song. You wanna jam it? And he doesn't get paid for that. And, you know, very often it won't hit the news. But occasionally it does, because the school will be like, oh my God, we need to let the local press know. And then it goes a bit viral or whatever else. But he's doing that all the time and going and doing charity stuff and just under the radar, doing really great stuff for people. And he's just a really good egg. He's so lovely, and he's obviously incredibly good at music as well. He's a pretty decent songwriter, and yeah, he's a really good human. He really is. So it's nice to be able to tell people that what they think. I think after a while, you know, if you're in the public eye and you're not actually a nice person, I think eventually the mask slips, or people come on and figure out that you're maybe not. Maybe there's something else going on, but he I don't think you can come across as nice as he does and not be. And I'm happy to report that he is genuinely brilliant and lovely and thoughtful and really, really good egg.
How did you come about? I mean, we'll get your backstory, how you got into drums and stuff. But how did you come about doing the drums as a sessions drummer, freelance drummer for Ed Sheeran? Because that's a big gig.
Yeah, I mean, so I've been doing it as a job for about 20 odd years now, just over 20 years as a sort of full-time employment. So you don't start off with the biggest gig in the world. You work your way up. You do weddings, bar mitzvahs, jazz gigs, funerals, anything, literally anything that will pay. And moreover, when it's your hobby as well, you just enjoy doing them. Having done it for 21 years or 20, 21 years, you start doing all sorts of stuff, and then somebody will go, oh, you're great. Actually, I'm working with an artist, and your playing would really suit them, or you should come audition. And then you do that and you meet people on that gig, a music director, for example, or a piano player or a bass player or something. And when that gig finishes, they go on and go, oh, there's this new girl who's just got this album out on Sony and they're looking for a band. I'll recommend you. And then somebody will go, okay, yeah, I know. I know him. I've seen him. He's great. Yeah. Okay. We'll hire him. Fine. And then that will finish, or somebody else will go, oh, I've seen you on this gig and I really like the way you play or your vibe or whatever. Can you come do my gig? And so really it's just that. It's word of mouth, really. Nobody puts an ad in the Telegraph or in the free ads or anything like that saying, drummer wanted, please hire me. It's really based on personal recommendation. I mean, say you're looking to get some shelves built or something. So you Google a carpenter, you'll look at the reviews. And if 110 people have reviewed them and 109 have said, this guy's great, then you'll probably go with that guy. It's the same in our industry, although because it's smaller, it's word of mouth. And it's that's really it. I mean, if you're good, and you're not a pain in the backside, because this touring malarkey is pretty intense. You know, we play, so we did an hour and a half show on Saturday night, and the next gig we've got is on Friday. So that's what, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. That's 5 days, 24 hours, or for all the waking day, you're next to people, you're with people, and you're having to get along with people.
You can't be a dickhead.
Yeah, maybe people that aren't your vibe or not your crowd or your people, or, you know, people from all different walks of life, people with different political ideas, people with different musical ideas, people that you wouldn't necessarily choose to hang out with at a pub, but who you work with. Sometimes you get super lucky and it's like, well, my best friends are on this gig and it's just a ridiculous holiday, basically. But other times, you know, you've got to fit in and not be a complete tool. You know, if you're really good at that 1.5 hour show, but then for the other 22 and a half hours of that day, oh my God, it's freezing in here, the air conditioning's on, or why is there cucumber in these sandwiches, and, you know, why has the dressing room not got Wi-Fi? You know, nobody will want to be with you.
Are there people like that that it's happened to in bands that you've been in where they've been annoying like that and they just got
very, very I mean, if you want to do a good, if you want to make it a career, you very quickly learn to cut that stuff out. Because, you know, not now, but certainly towards the beginning of people's careers, or, you know, people who are a bit younger or a bit greener, they don't know that stuff. They don't know that etiquette. In fact, when I was one of my very first gigs, like pop gigs of note with an artist, I replaced another drummer on it. this drummer was about 10 years older than I was. And I used to, before, when I was under 18, I used to sneak into jazz clubs to watch him play. Really killer player. And then I got a call from a mate who was doing this gig, and I'd bumped into him and sort of gone to jam nights that he was at. And we got along really well. And he was like, oh, I might give you a call about something. I was like, well, he's doing this gig. I know he's doing that gig. I wonder what he's going to give me a call about. Sure enough, the next morning he gives me a call and he's like, can you come and audition? Just meet the artist and just make sure that you guys are a good fit. I'm like, yeah, but hang on a minute. You've got this drummer playing for you, who's one of my favorite drummers. I used to sneak into clubs to watch him play. And he's like, yeah, you know, I don't need to talk about that just now. Just come down and check out the gig. And so I was like, right, I'm just going to keep quiet. I'm going to go down. I ended up really getting along with the artist, and they really liked the way I played. It was a good fit, and I ended up doing the gig, and I replaced this guy who was one of my favorite drummers. And after about three gigs, we were on a bus, and I was just like, I'm really sorry. I've got the elephant in the room. I've just got to ask. Tell me if I need to. Like, that guy you got rid of is so good. I'm 20 years old. I'm not nearly as good as, or 21 years old. I'm not nearly as good as that guy. Like, why? Because he's so good. What? Yeah, he's great. And for that hour and a half on stage, he was great. But again, for the other 22 and a half hours a day, it's like, well, why is the lobby call at 8 a.m.? That's ridiculous. We don't need to be there till 10. And why are we going on a bus? Why are we not flying? And why? And man, it was just too much. So the guy was fantastic. He was great. But he didn't last in that job because of all the other stuff that comes with it. It has to be a given that to do a job in this capacity, you have to be very good, very accomplished, at least good enough to be able to do it. The other stuff is what makes you get called back.
Yeah.
The other, the art lies in the detail. If you were, again, if you were a great carpenter, but, you know, and you went around to build some shelves in somebody's house and you did a great job and it looked like, you know, you painted a wall and it was like the Sistine Chapel and it was amazing. But you were like, where's my bloody tea? And, you know, like, are you not going to give us some food? Or you know, or they traipsed mud through the house, or you complained about just, oh, it smells in this house, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You could be the best carpenter in the world, but guaranteed you're not going back to that house for another job.
There must be a lot of really, really good musicians that are just going to be solo artists no matter what.
Yeah, I've recommended some great players and then got a call from the person I recommended them to the next day. I was like, oh, how did the gig go? Did such and such do a good job? Yeah, it was really good on stage, but man, it was a pain in the ass. Turned up late, didn't have the right gear. The gig sounded good, but it was stressful. And then you're like, oh, okay, all right. So you don't want to be one of those people.
So the first time you played with Ed Sheeran, I think was it when, it may not have been the first time, but there was a story about you playing on national radio with Ed. And he's quite fly by the seat of his pants, right?
Yeah, well, it's yeah, I remember that very well, yeah. No, you're right. Good homework. Well done. So yeah, we'd been a friend of mine, a mutual friend, Chris, who's a guitarist and a songwriter, great guitarist, was sort of jamming with Ed, had heard of Ed, was working in circles that Ed was around in, and said, check out this guy. And we all went to the pub together and we ended up, you know, singing out a lot of Westlife tunes and stuff and having a bit of a lock-in and just playing and getting on really well. And, you know, I had like a salt and pepper grinder and was using it as a shaker and banging on the table like a set of drums. And we were just all playing. And then we'd go back to the flat and, you know, end up jamming and playing and listening to music sort of through the night. And then all of a sudden, he got signed. That guy got signed. And I'd seen Ed a bunch of times. Just when he got signed, I was playing with Ollie Murs. We would do like Jingle Bell Balls. And we'd be, because Ollie was big at the time, we'd be headlining or the Girl Guides Jamboree at Wembley Arena. Wow. So we'd all be on these gigs and there'd be loads of different artists and I'd be playing with one or two of them and I'd keep bumping into Ed at these gigs and he'd be at the side of the stage watching. Oh man, it's cool. I like the way you play the drums. And you know, then we'd be like, oh, do you remember that night we had when we were singing Westlife covers and all that sort of stuff? So we kept seeing each other and he kept seeing me with other artists and all the rest of it.
So Ed was with you during that night where you were with the Salt and Pepper Shakers singing Westlife?
Yeah. Yeah, so he was just singing out Westlife covers and we were all just mucking around going like, oh, do you remember like that Backstreet Boys song? And we'd sort of jam it out and play it and then all sing harmonies and just be stupid and goof off and that sort of stuff. And then later on, he kept seeing me on these gigs because he got signed, he was put on these gigs and I'd be playing on these gigs as well. And he'd be at the side of the stage waiting to come on and watching us play. And I keep seeing you around, like, how you doing, man? And it's all cool. And it's, you know, great. And then he ended up doing a live lounge, which he needed a BBC Radio 1 live lounge, which he needed a band for. And we did a tiny little rehearsal and kind of got the song together and then went down to Maida Vale, MV4, I think it was, Maida Vale 4, to do the song. The red light comes on and all of a sudden you speak to the studio and it's like, oh, hey, it's Fern Cotton here, you know. Ed, you're going to play a song from your new album. It's you're going to play, I think it was Drunk. No, you're going to play something else and a cover. And of course, we'd done the cover. It was Empire State of Mind. You have to do one cover and you have to do a song of your own. So it was the Alicia Keys.
Good song.
Empire. Yeah. So we ended up doing that. And she was like, oh, we're going to come back and you're going to do one of your own songs, aren't you? You're going to do Drunk. And he was like, well, I wasn't planning on, I was going to do this song. And she was like, oh, I like Drunk. And he goes, okay, no problem, we'll play it. And then and she goes, great, well, we'll come back after this song. She plays a song, the red light goes off, and we all look at each other going, we don't know that song. The album's just come out. We don't know that song yet. And it's like, oh, it's fine, just you'll pick it up. And we sort of just strum the chords. So John on bass was like, okay, I know what key it's in. I kind of know the progressions now. We'll figure this out. And I was like, okay, so how does the beat go? And he sort of beatboxed it to me and said, oh, this is how it goes. 2 minutes, 20 seconds later, the red light comes on. Oh, we're back in the studio with Ed Sheeran. And you're going to play Drunk. And it's like, yeah, here we go. And we just play it. And we just, you know, we play the song that we weren't, you know, supposed to and we didn't know. So, yeah, he's got a habit of, and because he is so good, he'll just go, oh, well, we can do this and it'll be fine. And it usually is.
How did you go, though? Like, you just learnt the song in 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And lots of head nodding, sort of. Yeah, it's kind of like when you speak a language, you know, it's like music is a language, if you like. And when you speak that language, you anticipate how sentences are constructed. It would be a non sequitur, like I'm holding up a bottle of water. I'll go, this is a bottle of water. The bottle of water is green. Okay, I know which words I'm going to say because it's descriptive and I know enough about the language to know that when describing something, you'll use colours and you'll use weight or descriptors of an item, for example. And it's kind of the same in music. When you know it well enough, you know how things are going to go. You need to you know what people need to hear. Once you know a tempo and you know a rough structure, okay, it goes verse, chorus, verse, chorus. Choruses are usually louder, so you'll play slightly differently. And there's lots of head nods and sort of mouthing over the, you know, in silent over the studio. Coming up to the chorus, 2, 3, 4. So you know that you need to build to go into that chorus and such. So it's kind of like when you've been doing it long enough, you can kind of fill in the gaps to get away with it. I mean, ideally, you would rehearse it and you'd know the song coming in.
Ideally,
it'd be less pressure. But there are plenty of things you're able to get away with because you can sort of speak the language, if you like. But it's wildly, wildly stressful.
Wasn't there a time when you were on stage? It might not have been your problem or it might have been something else went wrong.
So there have been, you know, it's a very, very, very complex operation. If you've ever seen pictures of this mathematics tour, if you haven't, I'd recommend Googling it. Just Ed's stage on this mathematics tour. It's mad. So the stage, it's all in the round. So we're in the middle of these stadiums. Ed's on a stage in the middle, and that stage goes round and it goes up and down so all the audience can see him. And above that, there's a massive halo. There's lots of moving parts, and that halo is lifted up and down by these on these lines which come off these huge struts, and each band member is on one of those struts looking in at the stage. So it's a really complex, loads of moving parts, plenty of stuff can go wrong. But on one night, I think it was the opening night at Wembley, the halo didn't go up because one of the motors broke or something happened that was out of everyone's control. My electronics that I use on the drums, so you've got drum sounds on albums, but occasionally you'll have special effects and like sub drops or like do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do or ding or whatever, and you need electronic pads to make them work. Well, my pads went down, the electronics failed, a cymbal stand broke and a cymbal fell off the drum kit. I broke a stick in the middle of the first song, and this all happened within 2 minutes. And so that 2 minutes to all of us felt like the longest 2 minutes in the world. It was like, okay, I mean, I feel like what's going to happen next? The drums are going to catch fire and flip over and fall into the sea, or something ridiculous is going to happen. What could possibly more go wrong? Oh, no, it was in Melbourne, actually. It was in Melbourne. My girlfriend came to that show and was like, I came off stage, like, oh, God, can you believe what happened in the first song? She was like, oh, no, I didn't know this. I've seen the show before and it was great. And it was, okay, so nobody noticed anything went wrong. No, and that's, again, because everybody's so good at their job that, okay, so I've talked about it before. It's headroom. You want to be so good at something that when somebody throws a problem in, it's kind of like, imagine a computer using its CPU up to do something really, well, playing a song. For me, because I've been doing it so long, use about 5-10% of your CPU, of your ability, so that when something happens, you drop a stick, a cymbal falls off a stand, the electronics go down, the halo doesn't go up. Okay, well, that's bumping the CPU up to 20%, but I've still got 80% of headroom. So if stuff goes wrong, you've still got the mental and physical capacity to be able to play and get through it without it looking like a complete train wreck.
Can you talk me through a day where, let's say, you're playing at Wembley?
Well, we're both West Londoners, so Wembley isn't too far from us. We're not too far away from one another.
We're in Chiswick.
Yeah, and it varies depending on days. So Wembley, I'd be at home, for example. So I'd be at home the night before, get up, have some breakfast, go to the gym, and then you'll tend to go to a venue for a sound check. When you're on a tour, the sound check's super important, especially, so at the moment, all the gigs we've been doing with Ed on this mathematics tour, so for the last 18 months and continuing through, are all stadiums. And stadiums aren't necessarily built for sound. In fact, they're definitely not. They're usually sports arenas or sort of, you know, for different events that aren't music. So the sound will be entirely different. So for the front of house, for the people that mix the sound as you hear it, for the monitor engineers, people that mix the sound as we hear it in our ears, and for everything in between, it's different from venue to venue. So you'll have to sound check, you'll have to sit there, because my drums might, in Wembley Stadium, might echo a lot. In the MCG in Melbourne, when we did the Melbourne Cricket Ground, they didn't, because it's big and it's wide and it's open and they're not bouncing off of surfaces. So in order to adjust to that sound, in order for them to calibrate the sound as it needs to be in that particular venue, you'll go and do a sound check where you'll run a few songs. You might have some, there might be some new ideas, or something in the last gig might not have worked or might have worked really well. Somebody might have done something a bit fancy and everybody looks around and goes, wow, that's great. So can you do that again? Can you make sure you do that in every gig? So you'll rehearse that stuff. You'll just get comfortable on your instrument and then you'll finish that. You'll go to catering, you'll have something to eat, you'll hang out, you'll listen to some music, you'll talk about the show, talk about life. And this is what I mean. This is the downtime in which that's important for you to be a team player, where you just sat in the dressing room, chewing the cud and shooting the breeze and talking about, you know, life. And then you'll get ready, you'll psych yourself up. I might do some warm-ups on a pad to make sure that my hands and my feet are feeling warmed up and free and uninhibited. And then you'll go out and you'll do the show. And then you may or may not have a drink after the show or hang out, decompress. You know, it's a pretty, on these gigs, you know, we're playing to between 70,000 and 100,000 people a night. So that's, you know, there's a lot of adrenaline that's coursing around. So you'll rarely just go home and go, well, I'm going to bed, night, you know.
How do you wind down?
You talk with people, you know, you just hang out, you chat, you might have a beer, you just chill, you talk about how the show went. Or it might have gotten to the stage where I think we're on, I can't even remember what gig we're on, but we've been doing it for 18 months. It might get to the stage where, like, yeah, it's a good gig tonight. Oh, did you see that couple down in the front when we played Thinking Out Loud? The guy got on one knee, they proposed. Oh, yeah, there was a guy at the top as well who proposed. The spotlight went up there. That must have been what was going on. Or, you know, the traffic might be bad. So you'll just be like, oh, God, the traffic coming out of this. I wonder what time these people are going to get home. You know, anything really. But the excitement, the adrenaline's still there. If it wasn't, you'd be some sort of sociopath or psychopath.
Do you ever, I guess there's lots of other celebrities come into the changing rooms after, or the changing rooms, the green room, whatever it is, afterwards. Is that the case? Any big dogs come in there and kind of go, oh, and what do you do in the band?
Yeah. All the time. If you're a celebrity, then that begats celebrity, you know, there are people who, you know, who are quite cool. And some of them, you know, there are movie stars in there who I'm like, oh, look, it's...
Go on, drop some names.
Well, I don't know, but even guests that come in. So, like, last week we had, I got an opportunity, we all got an opportunity to play with John Mayer, who's one of my favorite guitarists of all time and a really great guy. And I sort of was that was my college, was playing along to his album, you know, like it was to Room for Squares when that came out, and then to Heavier Things when that came out. I loved those albums and I love his playing. And then, you know, before you know it, you get a chance to play with John Mayer and hang out with him. And I'm getting messages from, I had like 30-something messages from guitar mates saying, oh my God, you've got to play with John Mayer, you know, like what strap was he using? And, you know, like how big are his hands and all this stuff. You know, and so some of them like that, I'm like, oh my God, you know, I really like to talk to John Mayer and have a chat because we've got a lot in common. It's certainly music at the very least. And he's damn interesting. And I really like what he does. And I love what he brings to the table. And then a movie star will come in and it will be like, oh, okay, he was in that film. Okay, cool. Well, that's all right. I haven't seen that film. Or I have, and it was good, but I'm not going to bother him because he doesn't need to know about, you know, this or that, and I need, nor do I, so I'd let him have his space. But yeah, there are certain people who are like, oh my God, amazing. I just, you know, how are you doing? And you just want to chat with them. And then there are certain people who are like, oh cool, well they're here. Oh nice, okay, great. Or oh, they're taller in real life. Or oh, look at his hair, he's dyed it. Oh, he must be doing a different movie role, or he's lost weight, or, you know, all that sort of stuff. And yeah, and nobody's there to see Mark Pusey play drums. I mean, somebody might be, somebody, you know, somebody, I guess.
Hey, don't put yourself down like that.
Yeah. Well, my mum and dad, or my girlfriend, or
yeah,
some
your
mates.
Your girlfriend was there.
Yeah, if they're on a guest list, they'll be like, "Oh, look, Mark Busey's here." But nobody's, you know, I'm well aware of my place in the world. But you know, a movie star will come. Like in Australia, I think Chris Hemsworth or Liam Hemsworth. See, this is why I didn't check the name, because I wasn't sure which one it was. I was like, they'll come to the gig and they're brilliant and hilarious and massive. Or like, you'll be, oh my God, that's Thor! How cool, that's Thor! Yeah. But you know, just leave him to it. He doesn't want to know about Mark Pusey's day. He doesn't. You know.
He's got to worry about. He just wants to get a selfie with Ed.
There you go.
Where do you think Ed Sheeran will rank alongside? Because, I mean, these are big names, but Elton and the Beatles are, you know, two real biggies. Where do you think Ed Sheeran's going to rank alongside those guys long term?
That's a really good question, and I suppose it's, if you're looking at music as a competition, not a competition, but recently Rolling Stone magazine did an article on, I think, the 50 best singers or the 100 best singers, and I don't know a single person, musician or not, that was happy with that list. Aretha Franklin was in the top, Beyonce was in the top. It depends on your, how you're grading them. I mean, my favorite vocalist is Randy Newman. You know, like, you got a friend in me. You put Randy against Andrea Bocelli or somebody who's classically trained and has a beautiful operatic voice, and it'd be like, well, it's over. There's no competition at all. But when you're looking for storytelling in music, there's nobody beats Randy Newman, really, in terms of his writing. When Randy Newman sings that his heart's broken, he's not singing it like Andrea Bocelli because it's pretty and it's beautiful. He's singing it, and there's a certain pathos to the fact that his voice isn't beautiful. It's sad. It's really sad. Oh my God, he's not singing this because it's pretty. He's singing this because it's really going through it. And listen to the emotion in his voice. It's not a pretty voice, but listen to the emotion in it. It's great, and it takes you to a place. So given that music can't be ranked because there are different merits in everything, it's difficult putting, like, is Ed going to be as influential as the Beatles? No, probably not. But yes, to a generation. The amount of people that come up to me at shows, or because we walk through the crowd and or before shows, and goes, can you tell Ed I'm playing guitar because of him? Or you're outside a venue and you're walking into the venue. Can you tell Ed his music saved my life? And can you tell Ed that I'm doing my first gig next week and it's playing his songs because I learned him? So although the Beatles in history and culturally can never be matched because there was a zeitgeist that they hit the thing at the time where that's what the world needed. And they were so good. So, so, so good. That can never really happen again. But given that it's happened and music is evolving and changing all the time, different generations see different merit in different artists. So the Beatles, people in the children of the 60s and the 70s, that was the thing. And that continues to be the thing. Children of the 90s, like me, well, I was born in the 80s, but I started buying music in the 90s. Me and all my friends, we were buying Radiohead and Oasis and Blur and those albums, Manic Street Preachers, and playing along to them. So for me, they are as important as the Beatles. In history terms, probably not. But for a whole generation, they are. And for a new generation, Ed Sheeran, Lewis Capaldi, Taylor Swift, you know, people might balk at whether they like that music or not, but there are kids going to those gigs going, in the same way that I did, looking up at the stage and going, Mum, I want to do that. That's cool. I want to be in music and I want to do that because of these people. And certainly in terms of the musical canon of success, it's undeniable whether you like artists or hate artists. In terms of success terms and sales and radio play and having written songs that are going to be played at weddings and funerals for the rest of time, Ed is way up there. You know, is he as big as the Beatles culturally? Well, no, because at the time it was a perfect storm that made them be as big as they are, alongside the talent, obviously. But I know people who've played visiting hours at their funeral and people who've got married to Thinking Out Loud or Perfect. In terms of will he be recognised in 100 years? I think absolutely so. Certainly by a generation now, but just in terms of talent and in terms of having those songs that we were talking about earlier, those songs that affect people's lives and going, oh my God, he's saying in 3 minutes, 30 seconds, exactly what this process of bereavement's been like. Or, oh my God, do you know when he says that the way she dances and her hair catches in the light, that's my girlfriend, that's me and her, you know. He's got a great way of articulating what people are thinking. And for that, you know, he's definitely in that canon.
You mentioned Lewis Capaldi, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but did you watch him? I'm guessing you might have met him before.
And yeah.
Yeah. But did you watch him at Glasgow? And obviously he's such a favourite of he comes across as another great human.
I think, yeah, absolutely. And I don't think that can be an act. I don't think you can put that on and sell yourself as somebody who's down to earth and still likes a Greg's pasty and a McDonald's and all that stuff that he says he likes and fake it. You know, he really does seem genuine. I don't know him, but I've met him very briefly, but he seems genuinely like another good guy. And he's wildly talented and great, great songwriter. And fantastic artist and very relatable and a great singer, great songwriter. And I hope he's cool. I hope he gets the space he needs. And I hope he just feels a bit better because that Glastonbury was really super sad. And I don't know anything about Lewis or his personal life. I know some of the guys in his band who are brilliant. I just want the best for him. So I hope that he can. I hope that he feels better, and I hope that he can. If space is what he needs to take some time out, then that's wicked. Take the pressure off. Take some time off. If he decides that he can come back, that's wicked. If he decides he doesn't, then that's the right thing for him. But I think he's brilliant. I really do. I think he's great.
Yeah, he's amazing. Eh?
Yeah.
You've worked with Elton John as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
Like the first talk me through that. Like the first time you meet Elton John. You know you're going to be, I'm assuming you probably know that you're going to be meeting Elton John.
Yeah,
you must be absolutely bricking it.
Yeah, and Elton for me is the same. So when you're growing up, so when I was buying music, as I said, it was around the time of like Oasis and Radiohead and all that sort of stuff in the 90s. Britpop really was big when I was sort of just started buying music. But before that, before you're able to buy music, before you've got any sort of budget to be able to do that, when you're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, maybe, you're really listening to what's on in the house, which is a combination of either Radio 2 or your parents' music collection. And my parents, my mum especially, is a huge Elton fan. So it was on in the house from being a kid, and I loved it. I think he is such an exceptional musician. And Bernie Taupin, in terms of lyrics and the two of them working together, are absolutely sensational. And I think he's written some of the best songs. Well, you know, all that you saw are those people at Glastonbury, and you've seen the furore about his final ever tour. So I'm not alone. I think he's utterly brilliant. And, you know, you do get these pinch me moments where you'll get a call for a session or something, and it'll be an artist that you grew up listening. Oh my God. And you'll ring like Tom Jones. I'll ring my dad who likes Tom Jones and be like, Dad, I'm doing a tour with doing these gigs and these recordings or whatever with this, and it will be something from your childhood. And Elton was no exception. So you get a call to do that, and you're like, oh my God, so cool. And then you might get a chance to say hello or meet them or then work with them and jam with them. And and he was funny, sharp, like erudite, really witty, great storyteller, biting but in a hilarious way, really, 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 really good songwriter and fantastic, and all these other things as well, you know.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So you're sort of there. Wow, this is amazing.
Can you talk me through your interaction with him?
They've been, you know, so in studio jobs, it's sort of been very brief. You're there to do a job, but you know, you'll all go back and you'll listen in together, and there'll be feedback, and it's lovely, and he's very generous with his praise when he likes something and knows when he doesn't. It's just super cool and very funny. I mean, a lot of the sort of actual conversation I'd be wary of saying, you know, just get your podcast taken off the air, but he's very, very sharp, very, very witty and quick.
Talk to me about his songwriting, because obviously he's got a songwriter that did most of his songs. I mean I'm hugely ignorant on this, but
yeah,
so how does that work?
Yeah, so for a big part of his career, in fact for the most part of his career, he writes with a chap called Bernie Taupin, and Bernie is a poet, really. I mean, an absolute, the song Sacrifice, whether you like the song or not, if you listen to the lyrics, they are absolutely fantastic, about the splitting in a relationship, and it's heart-wrenching, and the music as well accompanies that. So it's have you ever watched a horror movie without the sound on? The soundtrack to that movie is as important as the visuals you're seeing, because it builds tension, and it seems that the same is true in their relationship. So Elton will write the music, the melody will top line, so to speak, and that means he will come, so it's A, G, or A, D, G, whatever, that's how the progression of the chords will go, and then you need to think of how the melody goes over the top of it, so not just the chords, but it's a human sign when things go wrong. So that's a top line, that's the line that sits on the top, that's in that key, that will, so he'll write that, but the lyrics will have been Bernie, and the way they work together, it's not just a case of write something to this, but they'll write collaboratively. That's obviously happened, but they'll write collaboratively and come up collectively with the most amazing stuff.
What about your involvement when you are working with Elton? Are you at all collaborating on any of his songs, or are you purely staying the hell in your lane because it's Elton John?
Well, you do, but you've also got to realise that. So really, it's through the producer, and the producer on those sessions was a chap called Giles Martin, and Giles Martin is one of the best, absolutely one of the best, for sure. His dad was George Martin, who was the Beatles producer. And Giles, in his own right, far away from what the great stuff his dad did, is staggeringly good, and really, really is fantastic. A producer on a session is kind of like a puppet master. So the artist will of course, miss the artist's gig, right? So they will either be very, have a lot of input, be, you know, very thoughtful and descriptive in what they want, or they'll be very hands-off and be like, I've written this song, I've hired you guys because I don't know how to play the drums, but you do. You know what will sound good in your experience to this song, so play it. If I don't like it, we can revise it, or I can say what I don't like about it. But really, I've hired you because I want you to make this song sound good. But we were trying to figure out ways to make this song sound good that we had for his album, and it was okay. So we'll try this idea. I think this will sound good. And then the producer will come in and say, "Well, do you know what? We're actually going to put some trumpets over the top of this. They're not here right now, but my plan is that Elton wants to put trumpets on the top of this. And I know that what you're playing will get in the way of what they're playing. So let's strip that bit out and play it differently. So we'll go for a different idea. And then that might work." And then the bass player will go, "Well, okay, hang on. If you're playing that, I'll lock in with that and do something else." And then the guitarist might go, "Okay, there's a space here, so I'll take a solo." Or so it's like, and then the producer and the artist are usually in the control room overseeing all this like a puppet master and guiding you in it. And every session's completely different. Sometimes an artist, not Elton, but I've been in sessions with artists where they'll go, "I want this to go doom, da, doom, doom, da, doom, doom, da, doom, doom, da, doom. And I want the fill to go da, da, doom, 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 doom." And you'll go, "Okay." And you'll sit there and you'll play it and they'll go, "Thanks, that's exactly what I want." And then you'll go into a different session with a different artist that will go, "I want some drums on this." And you'll go, "Okay, well, what are you looking for? Like, I don't know, like the song feels a bit yellow." I talk a lot about emotional intelligence, and it's true. You just need some emotional intelligence. So what does yellow mean, right? So yellow is bright. It's happy. It's sparkly. It's nice, right? It's not terracotta or muddy brown. So armed with those three descriptors, so it needs to be bright. Okay, so no big tom fills, like dug-a-dum, 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 dug-a-dum. So you might play with brushes or something light, and you might just play on the cymbals because it needs to be sparkly and it needs to be bright and colourful and yellow. Nothing too low end and nothing too like beating you into the ground with it. They want something floaty and sort of, you know, not doom, 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 doom. So if you have the emotional intelligence to take what somebody says, a descriptor, that somebody might not have thought too much. I mean, do you speak drums? Probably not. The public don't speak drums. And even songwriters will write something beautiful and be in a headspace when they write it. And they'll say, you'll say, "Well, what's this song about?" And they'll be like, "Oh, well, you know, there was a breakup, really horrible breakup I was going through. But then that led to me finding the love of my life." And then you go, okay, so now you're a bit more informed about the place they were in when they wrote it and the sort of soundscape you need to create in order for them to get what they want out of that song. So while they might not speak drums in particular, they'll give you adjectives and they'll give you descriptors to say, "This is how I was feeling when I wrote it, and this is what I want the mood to be." Or somebody might go, "Oh yeah, this song's dark, man. And you'll be like, okay. Well, you probably don't want those sparkly cymbals. You'll probably want some tom stuff. You'll probably want some intensity to the playing, some dynamic. You want it to be brooding and something like that. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And the producer...
It's a really good way of explaining it.
Well, the producer is the guy who will be the puppet master in the session. If the artist can, that's great. And they have very particular ideas, that's fantastic. And you'll deliver them for the artist. If they don't, it's you and the producer coming up with ways to try to bring to the surface what the artist would play if they were able to play drums.
That's so interesting. It's a whole new world that I never even knew existed.
Yeah, it's bizarre and creative. But again, it's having emotional intelligence.
Turning what you have now turned into a job is a pretty ambitious thing to want to do when you're a kid, and it's almost something that because it's not a natural necessarily career path. At what stage did you realize that this was an option, or was it the only option? Are you one of those people that was like, "Oh, I've only ever wanted to do this, so that's what I did because that's it," or did you have other options and this kind of just kind of rose to the top gradually? Or how did it come about? Because if I had a kid and they were like, "I want to be a drummer," I'd be like, "Yeah, cool, you can be a drummer, but you're bloody going to school, you're going to study, you're going to do all that," yeah, and make sure you have options. Like, what was your process?
That's a great question. There's a bunch of stuff to unpack in that. I mean, When people say, oh, you're lucky you get to do what you want for a living, I'm like, I spent 8 hours a day on my own in practice rooms for years, and I worked so hard to be good enough to be at a standard where you're doing this stuff, you know, stuff on a global scale, on a global stage, with artists that are as big as Ed and Elton and Andrea Bocelli and all these people. The luck comes into it, I think, in that it's all I wanted to do. The luck was, the lucky bit was, I didn't have an option. The lucky bit was, I was driven because I was obsessed. And the lucky bit was the fact that I was obsessed. I didn't manifest that. I didn't create that. And because of that, there wasn't really too much else I wanted to do. So I focused my time and I spent my time developing it and getting better at it just by accident. I wasn't sat in a room going, I want to be really good. I want to be really good. I want to be really good. It was just, I play a lot. And the more you do it, the better you get. And that's simply it. The 10,000 hour, the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hour rule. You do anything for 10,000 hours and you'll become an expert at it effectively. And that 10,000 hours was a breeze for me because it wasn't hard work. It was just an obsession. In terms of career path, growing up, I had lots of fantastic help from people I consider mentors, my favorite drummers in the United Kingdom, who were like, oh man, you know, you're good and you could totally do this. There's not much of a scene like there used to be, but somebody needs to do it. And, you know, you're well predisposed to be able to do it. So you should totally go for it. And I was a little bit like, I was the one going, oh, maybe I should go to uni and get a degree just in case, something to fall back on and all the rest of it. And I went to uni. I was going to study law. I wanted to be a litigator. I thought that was a far better career path and good money and all the rest of it. I loved law and I still do. I'm an enthusiast. And I went to uni and I was in my first year. I was like basically paying my way through uni, paying for my accommodation, paying for my halls, drinking money. You know, it was university after all. By basically doing gigs.
Wasn't there a moment where you almost blew in a big opportunity? Well, it wasn't a massive opportunity, but...
Yeah, it was a gig in a social club. It was a gig in a social club in Portsmouth or Gosport or Southampton or somewhere, I forget. But I was having there was a teacher. I was at uni and I was walking past these rooms that were basically on the campus that didn't belong to the uni, but were on the campus. And I could hear drums. I was like, it's a drum kit. And it's not a band because it's just drums. So I sort of hung around the thing and it looked like there was a queue of people looking to go and get drum lessons. And I made friends with this fantastic bloke called Glenn Clark, who's a great educator, a great drum teacher in Winchester. And we just became friends. And he would show me stuff, and it wasn't like I was having lessons with him, but I sort of was. And I was like, I'm a student. I can't really afford to pay. He was like, don't worry about it, man. Oh, by the way, have you seen this? And he'd show me something. He was great and really well connected and a lovely, lovely guy. And he was a great drummer, but moreover than the drums, he taught me the business. And he taught it specifically in one really important lesson. We'd been friends for about 6 months or so. And I get a call from him saying, hey, I can't do this gig on Friday night, Saturday night. So I've recommended you. You just need to learn a few songs and you'll play with them. It'll be great. And I'm like, wow, thanks, man. That's really cool. Great. What an opportunity. Brilliant. Okay, cool. And 10 minutes later, sure enough, my phone goes and it's the band leader. And he rings me up and he goes, you come recommended by Glenn. And he says you could do a good job. So the gig is this. It's this music. I can send you a set list. I can even send you a tape of the songs if you need it. And the gig is happening in Southampton on Friday night. Oh, I thought it was in Winchester. Oh, I'm really sorry. I haven't got a car. I thought it'd be down the road. I thought I'd be able to do it, but I'm so sorry. I can't get to Southampton. I haven't got a car. And he was like, oh, all right. Well, okay. Well, thanks anyway. Cheers, mate. Puts the phone down. 10 seconds after that, I get a call. My phone lights up and it's Glenn. And have you ever seen one of those cartoons where the cartoon character's on the phone and a mouth comes through the mouthpiece going like that? It's like that. I mean, Glenn was furious. And he was like, what are you talking about? I've just given you that gig. And he said, he's rung me up and you saying you can't do it. I thought you were free on Saturday. And I was like, well, I am free, but I haven't got a car. And he goes, are you mad? What are you talking about? Like, do the gig. I'm like, well, I haven't got a car. He goes, make it happen. Have you got any mates? I'm like, of course I've got mates. He goes, has any of them got a car? I was like, yeah. And he goes, give them the fee. If this is what it takes, if it's, I don't know, £100, give them 50 quid and say, go and buy a load of beer. Can you give me a lift down to my gig? And that's exactly what I did. I got my friend Aaron to take me down in his Ford Fiesta. And he waited around and I split the money with him. And it was a gig in a working men's club or something, a social club, for barely any money. But what happened was the band leader also did a load of tribute acts around the country. And he liked the way I played because I'd had an in and I did this gig with him. He's like, I've got, you know, it's not necessarily people's dream gig. It's not playing Wembley Stadium with Ed Sheeran, but it's work. And you're a blue collar working musician. And I was 19 years old, 18, 19 years old. And all of a sudden he's like, I've got these Elvis Presley gigs. There's 10 this month and they're 250 quid a pop. So there I am at uni. Oh. $2,500 a month doing Elvis Presley gigs, Elvis Presley cover gigs. And then they had another tribute act and another tribute act. And they'd be like, can you do this gig? Can you do this gig? And a bass player on one of the other gigs got me my first gig with Natasha Bedingfield. Because, and this all came from a call that I said, oh, I'm really sorry, I can't do that. And Glenn was like, excuse my French, you make that happen. You make this happen. I don't care how you do it. If you get a taxi and you do the gig at a loss, you do the gig. Because he was looking out for me. And he knew that I'd make a connection and I'd do a good enough job. This guy would recommend me and use me on other gigs. And on those other gigs that came out of this social gig in Gosport, I met connections, made connections that got me my first gig. And when that first gig happened, people were like, oh, this guy, you should use him. Yes. And that's how it happens. But it was all, I almost screwed it all up because... And Glenn taught me the absolute lesson in business. That really important lesson, which was, you can be as good as you want, but the way you're playing it, you're going to be the best drummer in your bedroom. And nobody cares about that. You need to go out and you need to gig and you need to make these connections and you need to not turn this stuff down. He didn't say it in quite such a sympathetic way. He was angry, and rightly so. Thank God he was, because I was like, God, I've got to make this happen. I've got to pull this out of the bag. Yeah. And as a result, one thing led to another, which is why I'm sat here. You know, like sliding doors. You could have taken a different life path.
And the lesson was to say yes and figure it out later.
Exactly that. Exactly that. Make it happen. Make it happen. And people, when people say, oh, yeah, but, you know, you were in the right place at the right time. Bollocks to that. Find out what the right place is and when the right time is and make sure you're there and ready. There are a few tropes which just sound like bitterness to me. Oh, I was lucky. Or he's got this because of this, or he's doing this because of that. And you'll rarely get that from people who are doing those things. You'll get them from people who want to do those things and are bitter about not doing them. Or, yeah, but, you know, right place, right time. It's like, yeah, cool. Well, I was in the right place at the right time. But what if I hadn't have done 15 years of practice up until that point? I'd have been in the right place, right time. That would have been my shot. And I'd have screwed it up.
You mentioned, like, people that are bitter that aren't where they want to be and that kind of thing. One of the great drummers that cops a lot of flack, who I know you're a massive fan of, Ringo Starr. What is it that makes him come under so much heat, and what is it that makes him so great?
Well, I think the heat comes from the fact that, you know, the Beatles, as far as, if people name the Beatles, they'll say, you know, Paul and John. Because they were the songwriting duo and they're staggeringly good, the best that did it, probably. And, you know, people, it's really people that don't know what a drummer contributes. It's ignorance. It's not meanness. You know, Ringo kind of talked like that. It was Thomas the Tank Engine. Sounded a little bit slow, for want of a better expression. When you're singing, if I had a blindfold on, and now somebody was like, whose voice is that? I'd be like, well, that's Andy's. I know Andy's voice, right? In guitar, the sort of sound you have or the choices you make or the solos you do, it's easy to identify a guitarist. It's easy to identify a piano player. Like the difference between Jules Holland, if Jules Holland was playing a bit of Boogie Woogie or Elton was playing a bit of Boogie Woogie versus somebody else. People have character in the way they play. And on drums, because they're not a melodic instrument, it's really difficult to develop and show character through drums. and choices. But that said, I bet I could sit down on a drum kit and play a Beatles song and you'd be like, that sounds like Strawberry Fields, or that sounds like Come Together, or that sounds like Ticket to Ride. Mm. His choices were so unique and so different as a songwriting drummer, as a creative, what I was talking about before, like the emotional intelligence, making those choices that are going to excel the song, make the song as good as it can be. Most of those songs in the Beatles catalogue, you could just go, doot-dat, 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 like a drum beat over, right? But instead, Ticket to Ride, Ringo goes with the guitar. He could have gone, but he didn't. He made a choice, which nobody else had played up until that point, that fitted so well with that music that it became inseparable. And just with the drums on their own, there are very few drummers. Stuart Copeland from The Police is another one that you'll play a little thing and it'll be like, that sounds like Walking on the Moon or whatever else. And to be able to come up with those parts that are so uniquely identifiable. That's Come Together. Those drum parts are so unique that even a non-drum will go, that sounds a bit like that Beatles song. Well, it is, and you don't speak drums. So it says so much about him and his creativity and his ideas. And then alongside that, just when he's playing a normal beat, it's so groovy. His pocket is so unique that that in itself becomes a descriptor. I'll go and do sessions and people will go like, it's kind of got a Ringo vibe to this. And I'll know exactly what they mean. There'll be a bit of swing. It won't be doom da doom doom da. It'll be it'll have a swing to it, a local, and to be so iconic as to have a style, a whole lexicon in your name, is bonkers. And he's brilliant, and he's funny, and he was Thomas the Tank Engine narrator, and he's cool, really cool guy. I love him. I think he's great.
RN Alive. Talk us through what that is and what your involvement is in it.
So the RNLI is the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. And they basically, it's a volunteer organisation, really, that go out to sea and rescue people who are in trouble of drowning, who get, I mean, if you think of a problem on the water, a fishing boat breaks down out to sea, or the sea's really rough and their engine breaks down, or people on the beach get blown out to sea on an inflatable, or they're swimming and they get caught in a rip and they get taken out to sea. That all happens around the coast. But because I live in London, the Thames is a really, really busy stretch of water, a very commercial river, and really, really quite dangerous as well. Lots of bridges, very, very tidal, lots of commercial traffic, people, boats crashing, all anything you can imagine sort of going wrong on a river goes in. And unfortunately, people deciding to self-harm, jumping off bridges into the water, all that sort of stuff. And the two busiest lifeboat stations of the RNLI are on the Thames. There's one in Chiswick and there's one at Waterloo Bridge called Tower Lifeboat Station. And I work at both of those. And
they're the busiest in the UK.
They're the busiest in the UK and in Europe. So last year, Tower got like 750-odd shouts, 750 999 calls. So on average, you know, a couple a day at least. I volunteer on those boats. So I, you do medic training, resus for drowning victims. Somebody might be working on their houseboat and might chop their thumb off or something. And, you know, you've got to go and get them out. Or a boat might be sinking and you have to pump it out and evacuate the crew. Or somebody might have self-harmed on a bridge and thrown themselves in. And then you have to pick them out and patch them up and get them to grown-up help, sort of a proper hospital. And it's so much fun. It's ridiculous.
So you mentioned how many call-outs you're getting. Like how often is that? How often are you recovering people, pulling people out of the water?
Fairly often, a few times a week. Either people that, you know, somebody could be on a party boat and they could be absolutely leathered and decide that it's too crowded to walk through the crowd. So they'll walk on the outside of the boat, but they're hammered and they fall in the water. and they get spotted. So we'll go and pick them up before they drown, hopefully. Or people on a bridge will jump in. Or a boat will sink that's, you know, really terrible, and it will go down fast. And they won't have life jackets, so you're recovering them out of the water. So it happens very often, very, very often.
Do people swim around, like jump off the bridge in London and jump off bridges in London to just for fun, or
with an intent to cause self harm? Unfortunately, it's very, very difficult at the moment for people. And I think before COVID happened, before the lockdown happened, there was one set of stats, and now there's a completely different set of stats. It's changed completely. It's you know, in some cases more than doubled.
Why is the Thames so dangerous? Like, why is it a dangerous river?
It's extremely tight. So even when I was young, before I knew it was tidal, I used to think that the height of the river was based on whether it had been raining or not. But really, it's tidal. That's water coming in from the sea, from the Thames estuary. So we've got water coming down from the source of the Thames, coming all the way through the land, water coming off the land. So you've got that fluvial flow pushing water out to the sea, and then you've got water from the sea coming in. So when the tide rises, it rises by, on spring tides, when the tide's at its highest and at its lowest in tidal movements, there's 7 meters of tidal difference between, but that's a lot of water between low tide and high tide. And so when that happens over 4 hours, you've got, so it's something like 30 centimeters, so the length of a ruler in 4 minutes. So if you've gone for a walk along a sandbank and you've fallen in some mud and you're trapped in the mud, that's raising the size of a ruler 30 centimeters every 4 minutes. And so every 8 minutes, that's 60 centimeters. Every 12 minutes, that's a meter thick. And if you're stuck in mud, that's over your head in 12 minutes, potentially. So there's that. There's the fact that it's so tidal and the water runs so quickly on that. When that amount of water is filling up the river that quickly, you can get speeds of up to 6 knots. Now, an Olympic swimmer swims at about 4.5 knots, maybe up to 6 knots on a sprint. So an Olympic swimmer swimming against the tide at 6 knots is just about not moving. And that's an Olympic swimmer. And so you've got the fact that the tide will take you out. If you jump into a bridge, jump into the water on a bridge, when the water's going at 6 knots, if you imagine that the stands in the water that are holding the bridge up, water will flow around those either side. But right on the other side of the bridge, there's a little vacuum where the water's flowing around, but around the bridge. Do you know what I mean?
So when if the water's going past the bridge and it goes past one of those poles that are hanging up, holding up the bridge,
yeah,
there's like the water kind of goes around the pole and there's like a little bit of a gap almost.
Exactly that. So that gap, that vacuum, that eddy, has to be filled up with water from somewhere. And that water is coming up, it's being sucked up from underneath the bridge into that void, to fill that void. And those eddies on those tides have meant that I've been there. I've been sat under a bridge watching somebody about to jump. All right, boys, keep your eye on her. She's going in. And she will fall into that void and just won't come up.
What?
Just won't surface. And you'll be like, okay, she went in there. Where the heck will it be? And we'll either get spit out further down or get churned around and then spit out further down the river. Or when the tide changes, we'll come up. That happens. That's happened. You'll get caught in one of those eddies. And it's not about how strong a swimmer you are. It's like a weir. It's like thousands of times. If you think that a meter of water square, like get a meter thick, a square meter of water, that's 1 metric ton of water. And you think about how many tons are moving per second past that bridge, you'd be the best swimmer in the world. You won't fight that off. Also, when the tide is low and you're coming off a bridge, the river is really far shallower than you think. In some places, you've got a meter of water. So it's like, oh, just jump in and swim. But you'll jump in and you'll hit the bottom.
Some places on the Thames, it's only a meter of water.
Absolutely, yeah.
Really?
Absolutely. In Putney, for example. There's just a meter of water underneath some of the arches at low tide. In fact, at low tide, you can see it looks like there's a beach on the side of the river in some places on the Thames. The tide goes out that much. And if you jump into the water and there's only a meter of water, you're going to end up, it's like jumping off a bridge and there not being water. It's just you'll hit the bottom. If you hit the bottom and get stuck in mud, you won't come up. If you hit the bottom and don't get stuck in mud, you'll really hurt yourself. You might get compression injuries. I mean, imagine dropping a tomato on the floor and a tomato, oh, it's fine, tomato's fine. Well, inside that tomato's mush. It might not have split the skin, but you get injuries like that, like compression injuries, internal injuries. You get cold water shock. So the river runs cold. The river runs really cold. And it's briny. It's not salt water. The salt water's coming in from the estuary, but of course the fresh water's coming down from the land. So there's no buoyancy. You get buoyancy in salt water, but there's no buoyancy really in fresh water. And if you're wearing clothes, you enter the river in clothes, then you're fighting a losing battle. Like I said, the water's really cold. And have you ever turned on a shower and it's been freezing? First thing you do is sharp intake of breath. Now, if you hit the water and you're underwater because you've just jumped off a bridge and you make that involuntary gasp, you've already lost because you're under the water having a lung full of water. So even if you surface, you're struggling and you've got water in your lungs and it's very difficult. Another facet of cold water shock is that all the capillaries on your skin and the outside of your body shut down in order for all the blood to stay around your central organs and in the center of your core to keep your motor functions working, to keep your life support system, your brain, your heart, your kidney, your liver, all the rest of it working. So all the blood rushes to the center of your body to try to keep it warm. And that brings on heart attacks, strokes, aneurysms, and all the rest of it. So that's just from being in the water off a bridge. That's alongside having an injury on a boat or a boat sinking. And six knots, wearing a life jacket, you come off a boat and you're getting shot down the river at six, and it's like being on a lazy river. Oh, this is quite fun. And then you'll come across a moored boat or a barge that is used to take waste, or a commercial vehicle, you know, a clipper, a party boat, something like that with a big, great big propeller that's going to churn you up, or one of those moored up barges. And you go into them and the six knot of water will force you underneath them.
Oh. And
so it really is best that people stay out of the river. If there's anything, there's some advice. So, and the non-time.
Does it happen often though? Does it happen often people just take clippers? Is this like a daily, weekly kind of thing?
Yeah, well, certainly a few times a week, there'll be people in the water that have entered the water either voluntarily or by accident. And that's really a priority. You know, that's a scramble. You scramble to them as quickly as you can. The person in the water is sort of the highest gradation of emergency you can get.
How quickly are you getting to people?
It depends on so much stuff. It depends on where they are. From what's called a cold launch. So if we're in our station and we get a 999 call, the bell goes. It's like a fire station. So you get straight into your gear, you run to the boat, and you launch. That happens both at Chiswick and at Tower within 90 seconds. So 90 seconds of getting the call, the boat's running, and we're on the way. We can get to anywhere in our patch within 15 minutes. And the patches are long. So Tower goes all the way from Barking Creek up to about Albert Bridge, sort of Battersea Way. And Chiswick takes over from sort of Albert Bridge, Battersea Way, all the way up to Richmond. So they're long patches. And it all depends on so much. You might be afloat. We might be afloat training, and we'll get a call from the Coast Guard, or hear something on the local network, Channel 14, which is basically river traffic channel, saying a mayday or a pan, which is somebody's in distress. And you'll be able to respond even quicker. But hopefully it shouldn't be more than 90 seconds before we're underway.
How long have I got if I've fallen in the water usually?
It's not all doom and gloom. You could jump in off a bridge and then be a strong swimmer and come straight to the top and be fine. Miss everything on the way down. It'd be a quiet day. Nobody hits any traffic. You could be bobbing around, or you could grab hold of a mooring buoy. But you can't do that forever, even as a strong swimmer. Tragically, off of London Bridge last year, we had a really tragic case of a woman intent on self-harming and jumping off a bridge. It was Tower lifeboat. Jumped off a bridge, and two males saw it, both of them really strong swimmers, jumped in to help her. And one was able to help her, and the other one drowned. But really strong swimmers involuntarily entered the river because they saw a woman drowning and drowned themselves. You know, really, really strong swimmer. And the woman survived. The woman that was despondent and had entered the water was able to grab hold of something and was fine. And the guy who was a strong swimmer who went in to help her died. And it just happens. There's no real rhyme or reason to any of it.
How do you guys get money? How do you guys operate?
So, yeah, the RNLI is completely funded by donations. It's a voluntary organisation. We kind of need your money to be able to carry on doing this because we're not government funded.
How do people donate?
They donate online, through websites, through, I mean, that's really how it's done. At events, there'll be card readers, there'll be, you know, people at football matches with buckets and all the rest of it. And yeah, there are numerous ways to donate. So at Chiswick, for example, on our social medias, it's at Chiswick RNLI. There's a little link you can go to for Just Giving site, and you can, you know, donate through that way.
What I'll do is, in the description to this episode, is I'll put a link in so people can just go on their phone, if they're looking at it right now, if they're listening to this, just scroll down, hit the link, and that should take you straight to that Just Giving page that's for the RNLI.
Yeah.
Well, good on you, mate. And thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been such a good chat.
Absolute pleasure. It's always fun just talking about stuff.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.